Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Robin Ince. That is Brian Cox.
My favourite topic we've covered recently on the Infinite Monkey Cage is black holes. It turns out that it's the one that's listened to most because people keep rewinding it.
I love the one that we made about spiders because we had guests that were just so passionate about the subject and you got scared when that spider came out. That little squeal was beautiful.
It was a spider running wild in Australia.
It is one of the most exciting episodes we've ever done.
The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some exciting news. My award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for a second season. We're bringing you more moving personal stories and more letters of advice from people all around the world. For daughters everywhere. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 6th of March. A month on from the devastating earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, an estimated 1.5 million people are still sheltering in tents. South Korea agrees to compensate its own citizens over crimes committed under Japan's occupation. And insiders say Twitter can no longer protect users from online abuse and disinformation. Also in the podcast, how an insurance policy could be key to preserving one of the most famous shipwrecks of all time. And
explore rich Swiss chocolat.
Matterhorn no more. Why Toblerone is changing its packaging design. The earthquakes in Turkey and Syria on the 6th of February left more than 52,000 people dead and at least 156,000 buildings destroyed or damaged beyond repair. But what is life like for those remaining in the disaster zone? A month after the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck, an estimated 1.5 million people are living in tents among the rubble of their former homes, as Anna Foster reports from southern Turkey.
Not everyone is leaving Iskenderun station. The trains do still pull out regularly, and now they're free, carrying people away from this devastated region. The Turkish disaster agency AFAD says almost 2 million have now left. But two long rows of carriages here don't move at all.
We've turned this place into a home. Me, my wife, my daughter and her husband, and my two grandchildren. The quarters are clean. Outside, they provide tea, soup and fruit juice and cake to the children.
Yilmaz Cucuk and his family live on board this train now. The luggage racks are filled with the few possessions they managed to retrieve from their damaged home.
They wanted to put us in tents, but I refused. Tents are cold, and this place has a notoriously strong wind. When it blows, all the tents will end up in the sea.
Many families are living in tents, but there aren't enough to go round. Some have moved into sprawling new encampments guarded by the Turkish military. The better ones have portable toilets and playgrounds for the children. But some people are determined to stay as close to home as they can, even living right next to the rubble, like the Yücesoys. In the shadow of this building, which is leaning to one side with cracks in the walls, steps away there's a tent, and they've put coloured solar lights, because at night that is the only light they have now here. There's no power. They've moved some of their plants, even a small side table and a picture. They're doing everything they can to build a new home outdoors. Muzian Jelip is 74 and she's living in the tent next door with her husband. Their cows are close by. The couple are keeping watch on their house from across the road.
My valuable articles are in there, and thieves are roaming around. Bang, 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 gunshots. The police are barely keeping them away. So many thieves, how can I live here?
More than 160,000 buildings were destroyed or left badly damaged in the quake. Work has started to demolish the dangerous ones, but there isn't enough mechanical equipment in the country to do a job like this quickly. That noise you could hear is the arm of a crane pounding the last supporting structure of a building, which is still standing for now. It's leaning to one side, and they're trying to bring it down fully. Back in Samandar, night is falling, and it's time for dinner. Chicken and potatoes cooked on a camping stove and eaten from paper plates. Nobody knows how long they'll be living like this for, but they do know that crucial presidential and parliamentary elections should be happening in just over 2 months' time, and basic shelter for earthquake survivors has now become one of Turkey's biggest political issues.
Anna Foster reporting from southern Turkey. Disputes over Japan's brutal 35-year occupation of Korea before and during the Second World War have long poisoned relations between Tokyo and Seoul. There have been some attempts in the past to agree Japanese compensation, only for the row to erupt again. Now, South Korea has agreed to compensate the victims itself, but that has angered Korean survivors who say Japan should pay.
The government says it's a done deal now with the announcement of the solution to forced labour, but this is invalid both legally and in terms of public sentiment. We won't stop marching vigorously until it's scrapped.
It's so pitiful. The government is pushing ahead with pro-Japanese trade negotiations that trample on the established legal rights of its citizens and exempt Japanese war criminal enterprises from legal responsibility. It is unacceptable violence.
Co-chairman of victims groups there. So why is Korea paying when Japan was responsible? Jean McKenzie is our Seoul correspondent.
Because this agreement is actually, as you've hinted at, about so much more than just compensating these victims for the horrendous conditions that they were forced to work in during Japan's occupation of Korea in Japanese factories and Japanese mines. They were treated appallingly, they were paid nothing, and they were, in their words, treated as slaves. But this is not just about compensating them. It is about fixing the current relationship between South Korea and Japan. Relations between these two countries have been marred for decades because of these issues stemming back to the colonial period. And this has been one of the final sticking points. So when the South Korean president, the new president, came to office last year, he promised to mend relations with Japan. This was his sort of flagship foreign policy. But it was really this issue he was going to have to resolve to move things forward. And so he's found a way, albeit an unpopular one, because the Japanese companies are off the hook and South Korean companies are going to step in and foot the bill. But South Korea has been working with Japan behind the scenes for this for months. They knew the Japanese companies wouldn't pay. And so this was going to be the only way to move forward. South Korea and Japan are facing very similar threats right now in Asia, in East Asia. They're both dealing with this growing threat posed by North Korea, the rise of China, both key allies of the US. And the US wants all three countries to work much more closely together on issues of security. And this agreement certainly paves the way for them to do that. So yes, the families and the victims are bitterly disappointed and they will protest against this. But it's being seen here in South Korea, in Japan and in Washington as a diplomatic success.
Jean McKenzie in the South Korean capital, Seoul. When Elon Musk took over Twitter last year, he sacked a lot of the staff. It was an attempt to slash costs, but there were warnings that it could make the social media site more toxic. Now, a BBC investigation has been told that Twitter is no longer able to protect users from online abuse, child sexual exploitation, or state-sponsored disinformation. The BBC's social media and disinformation correspondent Mariana Spring spoke to both former and current staff of the BBC's Panorama programme. She told Justin Webb what she'd learned.
I had lots of people reaching out to me on Twitter and elsewhere, telling me that the hate that they were receiving and seeing, as well as disinformation and other harmful content, appeared to be on the rise. And so I set out to figure out whether that was true. I heard from rape survivors who've been targeted by accounts that were less active before Elon Musk takeover, and that since appear to have been reinstated or are newly created. Exclusive data for Panorama shows that there's been an uptick in new accounts following misogynistic and abusive channels, 69% more than before Musk took over. And we looked at the online abuse I receive for doing the reporting that I do on disinformation and conspiracies, and that's more than tripled since the takeover. And so I set out to meet current and former employees who told me about the work they were doing to protect against online harassment and trolling, and specifically features that were designed and, according to Twitter's research, suggested had some effect that they just either weren't there working on anymore or aren't able to maintain because of the reduction in staff and because of the chaos there. And a lot of people spoke about this chaotic work environment, describing Elon Musk walking around the office with bodyguards at all times and even trying to sell back the office plants to Twitter employees. There's one senior engineer I've spoken to. He's still at Twitter, so he's agreed to speak with us anonymously. And this is an actor's voice, but this is what he had to say about what's happening on the inside.
It's like a building where all the pieces are on fire. When you look at it from the outside, the facade looks fine, but I can see that nothing is working. Now, a totally new person without the expertise is doing what used to be done by more than 20 people. Well, that leaves room for much more risk. Many more possibilities of things that can go wrong.
And those things that can go wrong, of course, felt right around the world. And we've seen this on Facebook in the past, haven't we? When people aren't monitoring this stuff, it can very quickly get out of control.
Yes, and it's not just about trolling and harassment. It's also about other issues like child sexual exploitation. I've spoken to someone who previously was working on a team dedicated to that. That team has gone from 20 people down to 6 or 7. They're really worried about the ability to escalate this kind of content to law enforcement, which they say is more important than suspending accounts, even though Twitter says it's removed 400,000 accounts in just a month to protect against that. And another employee I spoke to who worked in threat disruption told me how his team, who were daily identifying these kinds of networks, no longer are doing that, and he fears the implication of that. He says that that means these networks go undetected.
Is this just sour grapes, though, from people he's got rid of? Because the fact is, he's got rid of a lot of people, hasn't he? And yet Twitter still exists, and it still exists for a lot of people in a perfectly satisfactory form.
Everyone I spoke to admitted that Twitter wasn't perfect before, but they showed me the tangible work that they were doing to better protect users. They were going on the record for the first time, and they'd been really reluctant to speak out because they don't want to seem like they're sour grapes, but they care about the users. And I wanted to put these questions to Elon Musk and Twitter. I tried every way possible to get Elon Musk to speak to me, including doing a Twitter poll, not a real poll, but the votes that Musk has used to make decisions about the platform. And the poll did very well. Over 40,000 people voted. 89% said they wanted Elon Musk to do an interview with me and BBC Panorama. He didn't reply, and Twitter and Elon Musk are yet to reply to the points raised in the Panorama investigation. Although, as of this morning, Elon Musk has responded to a comment that was critical of Panorama, saying that he was rolling on the floor laughing. And I imagine that for lots of the users I've spoken to impacted by this, they'll still be left with questions as to what Twitter is doing to protect its users. Twitter has said publicly that it still holds protecting its users' voice and its freedom of expression at the core of its mission, its values.
Mariana Spring, the BBC's social media and disinformation correspondent. A year ago, one of the most famous shipwrecks of all time, Ernest Shackleton's Endurance, was discovered at the bottom of the sea in Antarctica. The explorer's vessel had sat there perfectly preserved since it sank in 1915 after being crushed by ice. Now, experts have found the vessel's insurance policy, which could hold the key to future conservation plans. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has this report.
It was the shipwreck they thought would never be found. But a year ago, Sir Ernest Shackleton's lost ship, Endurance, was discovered, lying 3,000 metres down in the Antarctic deep, almost perfectly preserved, frozen in time. But this remarkable find has set the expedition team off on another quest. This time at Lloyd's Insurers in the City of London. Whenever a large ship is lost to the sea, it's recorded in pen and ink in a loss book. It's a tradition that still happens today, but it goes back to 1774, and the hope was they'd find a Shackleton ship on the day she sank. we've come to where the archives are stored. There are 140 lost books going back hundreds of years. Shackleton's Endurance sank in November 1915. But the news of the sinking in Antarctica took a while to reach London. And in fact, the record has been discovered in June 1916. And now, a century after it was written, the book is being opened up again.
So these were all the lost books from Lloyd's, and this is the lost book.
John Shears, who discovered Endurance in Antarctica, has brought Alexandra Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton's granddaughter, to see the record.
And as you can see...
Amazing.
Endurance, British, crushed by ice in the Weddell Sea, and afterwards foundered...
He would never have seen this entry, would he?
That's a good question.
It was an amazing experience. I didn't know there was an entry in the lost book. I knew very little about the lost book. It's all part of the amazing pattern of more and more information surfaces.
We know from Shackleton's diary that the ship sank beneath the ice on the 21st of November 1915. It took the Endurance crew 6 months and a trek of hundreds of miles to get to safety. Incredibly, they all survived. So Shackleton was only able to send a telegram back to a newspaper in London at the end of May 1916.
Your grandfather sent a report on the 31st of May from the Falklands.
Yes.
That was reported by the Chronicle in their late edition on the 1st. Shackleton's ship, Endurance, was the first ship to be insured, what Lloyd's called, into the ice zone. At that time, she was one of the strongest wooden ships ever built. So Lloyd's actually thought that she was a very good risk. But, of course, he lost the ship. And lucky for him, he had the insurance policy, and we now know that the insurance policy paid out.
So what will happen to the wreck now?
I think she should be left as she is. It's miraculous. She still exists in the wonderful, beautiful form she is. She should just be left there. I've even had people come to say to me, it's better she would never discover, more romantic. But I'm very happy she has been discovered, but I never thought there would be images, let alone beautiful images.
So for now, the ship will be left, resting in the darkness of this remote corner of the world. But her stories and the discoveries will keep on coming.
A report by Rebecca Morrell. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It's one of the most shocking surprises I've had in 25 years of being an actor.
You're part of the history of the cinematic world.
It just seems like really surreal. It's a dream come true.
Ahead of the Oscars, we hear from the stars of one of the top nominated films. One of the big promises of Brexit was that after the UK left the EU, it would be able to take back control of immigration. However, over the past 5 years, the number of people entering Britain illegally has quadrupled. The biggest rise has been in people arriving in small boats, more than 45,000 in the last year alone. The government is under pressure to act, and so tomorrow it will introduce a new law calling for those migrants to be deported as soon as possible. The opposition says it's simply a gimmick that won't work.
What the government's doing is a cynical rehash of previous failed immigration policies in the hope that by generating headlines with unworkable policies, the public might be duped into thinking they're finally doing something about small boats.
Where's streeting of the main opposition Labour Party? So what is the government saying? I asked our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
What the government is saying, Oliver, is that it has several strong reasons. Number one, that a country must be in control of its borders, so you can't have what's happening in the future. Number two, that it's unfair on immigrants who try to come here in ways which are more, I suppose, what the government would call conventional. Three, that it undermines faith in the immigration system amongst the voters, and it is a very big issue with many people in the UK, the opinion polls suggest. And that essentially... it's a huge sort of strain on Britain's social services. So those are the main arguments.
Yeah, so the idea is to deport anyone arriving as soon as practicable and then ban them from returning. It's not only Labour criticising it, unions and refugee groups are unhappy too. Can it work?
You summed up the policy nicely. I mean, it's essentially to declare that anyone who comes here in a small boat, you have come here illegally. And ideally, what the government wants to do is to detain people for no more than 28 days and then send them away. Now, the criticism is widespread, and it sort of splits into three main categories. One is that it's just immoral that a lot of these people, certainly from last year, many of the Refugee Council found were genuine asylum seekers. Secondly, that you're in danger of violating UN conventions on refugees, on UN conventions on human rights over detention. And then the third one, of course, which there's been a lot of focus on, is that it's just massively impractical, that where are the facilities to detain people? And then, of course, where on earth are you going to send them to? Because although the UK government has reached an agreement with Rwanda, nobody has actually been sent there, and the policy is being reviewed by the courts, a process that may take another year. And, of course, since Britain left the European Union, it doesn't have agreements with other EU countries on returning asylum seekers from the countries they came from in Europe, of course, including France.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. Events and rallies have been held in Venezuela to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the death of President Hugo Chavez. Mr. Chavez was hugely popular, using Venezuela's vast oil wealth to fund social programs. But he was also divisive. Our Central America correspondent Will Grant was based in Caracas during the Chavez years. Charlotte Gallagher asked him how the Venezuelan leader is remembered.
The way that people define Hugo Chavez very much depends on their political position. His supporters, who you heard cheering there, would define him as, you know, essentially a saint. Really, they almost deify him in Venezuela, those who adored him in life. They credit him with pulling millions of people out of poverty. They thank him for that and will do for as long as they have breath in their bodies, quite honestly. But of course, the other side of the coin are those who feel that he just descended the country into an autocracy, made the most of a very high oil price for the cheapest kind of populism and anti-Americanism. The truth of the matter is that either way, he is probably the most significant political figure to emerge in Latin America of the modern era.
And how has Venezuela changed since he died?
Well, his successor, Nicolas Maduro, who was then his foreign minister, inherited the sort of tail end of the revolution, if you like. It was beginning to curdle. It was running out of steam in all sorts of ways, politically, economically significantly. The price of a barrel of oil, of Venezuelan oil, dropped significantly. Production was worsening with a lack of investment in the state-run energy company PDVSA. And so the most and significant thing that has happened under the Maduro era is the collapse of the Venezuelan economy and the subsequent exodus of people from the country. So many millions, essentially, young people have attempted to make other countries in South America or obviously make it to the United States. And of course, there were very large and significant anti-government protests, lest we forget, which were met with brutal force by Nicolas Maduro's government, and many hundreds died.
And what are the government trying to do to stop this exodus of people desperately leaving the country?
One of the first things that Nicolas Maduro has tried to do in recent months is to essentially dollarize the economy, not a very kind of socialist revolutionary economic policy, but one that he was faced with no other choice in doing. Such was the weakness of the national currency, the Bolivar. I think ultimately for the Venezuelan socialist revolution to sort of reinvigorate to the days that it enjoyed under Hugo Chavez, the key thing is for its oil price to bounce back and for that investment in PDVSA to allow there to be the kind of production so that they can make the most of these incredibly large oil reserves that it has, the largest proven reserves in the world, actually. So as Nicolas Maduro's attempts to sort of shore up the economy, we may see that that gives him the platform to essentially remain in power for as long as the United Socialist Party decides that it's going to be there.
Will Grant, our former correspondent in Venezuela. It's long been the most recognisable of Swiss chocolate bars, but the makers of Toblerone are going to have to remove the picture of Switzerland's most famous mountain from their triangular packaging. It's all about how Swiss the product is, as Imogen Folks in Bern explains.
We all know Toblerone for its famous triangular shape, and we also know it, or certainly for the last more than 50 years, the branding on the outside is Switzerland's most iconic mountain, the Matterhorn. And there's even an old fable that the inventor of Toblerone, Mr. Tobler himself, shaped the chocolate bar in that shape because he loved the mountains so much. But Now, this chocolate, always made right here in the Swiss capital, Bern, it's also going to be made in Slovakia. That's because it's so successful. It sells so much, they need more capacity. But it means, under a law on Swissness, you can't use the Swiss flag, you can't say made in Switzerland, and you can't use pictures of famous Swiss symbols. So the Matterhorn's going to have to go from the label, and instead of Switzerland, they're going to have established in Switzerland on the packaging. And although the Swiss here want to protect their brands, a lot of people are a bit upset. They were upset by the move to Slovakia. They're upset that this iconic packaging is going to go. They're also a little bit upset that this famous chocolate is actually owned for many years now by this huge American food giant, Mondelez, who have said this week that the Matterhorn symbol is going to be replaced by a modern, streamlined mountain, probably not associated with any geographic region in the world.
Imogen, folks, in Bern. The Banshees of Inisherin is taking the cinema award season by storm. The Irish film has already won 4 BAFTAs and been nominated for 9 Oscars. Our correspondent in Hollywood, Sophie Long, has been talking to some of its stars.
Now, if I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me, I just don't like you no more.
The Banshees of Inisherin focuses on an intensely local conflict between two men when one unilaterally declares an end to their friendship. But it's resonated around the world and led to Oscar nominations for both Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell.
Yeah, mad. Did not see it coming. It's one of the most shocking surprises I've had in 25 years of being an actor, how this film has been received. Because it did feel like one of the most beautiful things about it, and one of the things that made it such a joy to lean into the process of making this film was how kind of colloquial it felt. But of course it's not. And colloquialism is often a choice. Outside of certain linguistic details and nuances, colloquialism as a mentality is a choice, really. Do you know what I mean? Globally, universally, we all do go through much of the same things.
Yeah, it's quite...
What's the best bit about being nominated for an Oscar for you?
Just that they can't take it away. It is. Yeah. It's like, part of the history, you know, you're part of the history of the cinematic world in a way that I wanted to contribute to it. And I've tried for the last 30 years to do so and to do it in a way that would be meaningful. So it pushes the film out, but also for me, like, I'm 67 years old now, so it's a nice kind of like,
you're
at this end.
Past 66.
Can't be waiting around for any more of this madness.
Let's just call it quits.
We won't call it quits.
The film, which intermingles the picturesque and profane as it explores the complexity of friendship through brutal, dark comedy set against the beautiful backdrop of Western Ireland, has no less than 9 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director for Martin McDonagh and Best Supporting Actress for Kerry Condon.
Well, I just start giggling because it just seems like really surreal and something I've wanted my whole life. Yeah, so it's a dream come true.
But us gang of friends being here with a film that we care about and like, and it isn't really Oscar bait. It's kind of unusual and darker than some of those can be. To be proud of something and to have this kind of glamorous, strange, almost silly thing as part of it too is, I like it.
What are you doing home? Brother, what are you doing home?
I knocked on Colm's Sonny Laurie, he's just sitting there.
Sitting there doing what?
Sitting there doing nothing. Smoking.
Was he asleep?
He was smoking, Siobhan. How do you smoke in your sleep, like?
Have you been rowing?
What are you going to wear?
Don't know yet. Everyone just be asking me that. Like, I've nothing but time on my hands to be perusing Vogue. Like, there's about 20 billion outfits to be wearing before the Oscars.
You've got people coming up to you and wanting to dress you. And
oh, yeah, like, of course. I feel like a princess.
Yeah.
Oh, the question on everyone's list. What are you going to wear, big man?
I know what I'm going to
wear. I know what he's going to wear as well. Watch out. Watch this face. Oh, yeah. Tasty.
The stars of the Irish Oscar-nominated film The Banshees of Inisherin in conversation with Sophie Long. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Jack Graysmark and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Robin Ince. That is Brian Cox.
My favourite topic we've covered recently on the Infinite Monkey Cage is black holes. It turns out that it's the one that's listened to most because people keep rewinding it.
I loved the one that we made about spiders because we had guests that were just so passionate about the subject, and you got scared when that spider came out. That little squeal was beautiful.
It was a spider running wild in Australia.
It is one of the most exciting episodes we've ever done.
The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.